Welcome to Lead Follow, a podcast for pastors and leaders, hosted by MCUSA Executive Director Glenn Guyton. Join Glenn as he talks to folks across the denomination to help equip today's leaders who are leading while following Jesus.
Hello, this is Glenn Guyton, and during this season of Lead Follow, we'll be exploring ways to reimagine church. Today, I am pleased to welcome Dr. David Brubaker, who will be discussing navigating change. David recently retired from his role as Dean of the School of Social Sciences and Professions and is now Professor Emeritus of Organizational Studies at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. He has trained or consulted with over 100 organizations and is the lead author of When the Center Does Not Hold, Leading in the Age of Polarization. Dr. David, welcome.
Thank you, Glenn, and please call me Dave.
All right, Dave, I'll call you Dave. Thank you. Well, it's so good to have you here today, and I think that you have a very relevant topic for the world we're living in. But I want to start off with a question. We're talking about reimagining organizations, and as an organizational expert, this should be right up your alley. But reimagining an organization involves transforming how it operates, thinks, and achieves its goals. It's about taking a fresh, innovative approach to every aspect of the organization to enhance its efficiency, adaptability, and overall success. So if you had your magic wand or your spiritual wand, however you want to frame it, if there was one thing that you could change or reimagine about Mennonite Church USA, what would it be and why?
Well, to quote Simon Sinek, who writes very, very well on this topic,
yes.
Start with the why.
Start with the why.
Why do we exist?
Okay.
And a good mission statement will basically say who we are and why we exist. So if it's a congregation, mm-hmm. I would say it exists. There are particular reasons, but in general, congregations exist to serve their members and serve their communities.
Okay.
If it's a conference, it exists to serve the congregations, and it also exists to serve the leaders of those congregations. And if it's a denomination, it exists to serve the conferences and the broader society and the world that it's part of. So get the why right. Why do we exist? And that's one of the best ways to start a change process that will take us in the direction that we want to go.
Yeah. Is that, I mean, it sounds simple, but is it, why do organizations struggle so much with that why? Like just focusing in on that?
Because I think we overcomplicate it.
Okay.
I've seen paragraph-long, in fact, I've seen multi-paragraph-long uh-huh. mission statements, which nobody can remember
yeah.
or hang their hat on.
Yeah.
And so it's ideal if we can have a one-sentence mission statement.
Okay.
And MCUSA has a very good one, the vision statement about healing and hope.
Yep, yep.
It's still a bit long,
okay.
but it takes us in the right direction,
that
through us, hopefully, God can bring healing and hope to the world.
All right, well, maybe we need to look at that as we reimagine the church and figure out how to simplify it. And I think that, I've had other guests during this season of the podcast, and that seems to be a common theme about simplifying things. And by no means is the structure that we have in this denomination, or probably any Christian denomination, by no means is it simple.
So Phyllis Tickle, who wrote an excellent book on the Great Emergence, passed away about 10 years ago. But she said that the Christian church has been through a major transformation every 500 years.
Every 500, okay.
And she starts with identifying the fall of the Roman Empire, the emergence of Gregory the Great, who provided leadership for the church after the fall of the Roman Empire, and then the Great Schism in 1000 AD,
yeah.
okay. between the East and the West, and then the Protestant Reformation, 1500. And now we're due for another one, and it's clearly happening. But
yeah.
her point is that even though it's unsettling, these transformations, it's a time when God has worked through what appeared to be very messy to bring about something very good.
Yeah.
And so God does God's best work when things look pretty bleak.
Yeah, so every 500 years, and I think some in this organizational change career field would say that process of just organizational change, not just thinking about church, is really accelerating, like how often things turn over, that cycle has accelerated.
Yeah.
But as we look at these shifts and these cultural shifts, these changes that are happening in society, that are happening in the smaller context of the church, what are some things that churches need to consider when trying to navigate these shifts?
So I have worked with enough congregations and other organizations in transition that I started to identify some patterns.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm going to take some notes.
Ultimately, you got it down to four T's.
Okay, four T's.
For successful organizational change. And the first was team.
Okay.
The congregations, organizations that did it right formed a team.
Okay.
Some kind of a change management team or a visionary team. The way I say it is lone rangers always fail.
Ooh.
So if you try to do it by yourself, it's not going to succeed.
Okay.
And I've seen many of those cases. But if there's a team, doesn't need to be large, 5 to 7 members.
Okay.
That represents some of the diversity of that congregation or organization.
Yeah.
That's the right place to start.
Okay.
The second is tone.
Tone. All right.
That people need that why in front of them. They need to have a positive vision for the future.
Ooh.
Because as we're going through transition, things get worse before they get better.
Yep.
And it's like when Moses was leading the children of Israel mm-hmm. out of Egypt.
Yep.
They got into the wilderness, and what did they say? We just want to go back
to
Egypt.
We want to go back to Egypt, yeah, yeah.
Because at least we had food and water. And that is typical for any significant change process.
Yeah.
So we have to set a tone that's positive,
okay.
Not to deny the pain that people are experiencing.
Yeah.
That's actually important. But we remember Martin Luther King not for his I Have a Grievance speech, but for his I Have a Dream speech.
I Have a Grievance speech, okay. It,
even though he was very clear about his grievances.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we need both. We need to identify what's not working, but we also need to identify what could be working if we are willing to change.
Okay.
That's the vision. So team, tone, time is the third.
Okay.
That significant organizational transformation usually takes years, not months. And so people that set out trying to do it in 3 months or six months generally find that it's not successful because the time frame wasn't enough. I'm not talking about restructuring or other kind of changes that we can sometimes make in 6 to 9 months.
Right, right.
But major cultural shifts,
yeah.
Those take time.
But I think sometimes, I think the church is notorious for taking forever for something that could be solved pretty quickly, right?
Yes.
Like, so I don't know if I want to encourage them to take time, but I get what you're saying. But sometimes I think we stretch that one out a little bit. So I'm going to put an asterisk by that for the Mennonite Church.
So let's say that we have a congregation located in a downtown community where there's been significant demographic change and the members moved away but are driving in.
Okay.
And that congregation says, we want to become a church with, of, and for the community, not just a commuter church.
Yep.
That's going to take several years to accomplish that change.
I agree. Yep.
Yeah. So I'm talking about the major cultural shifts and demographic shifts.
But like picking the color of the carpet shouldn't take years.
No.
They should be able to decide that in a week or two probably.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I have a Quaker friend who talks about the reality that consensus is needed to make decisions. And so that it can be a decade to make that kind of decision. Even though I respect that tradition.
Yes.
We can't always give that kind of time.
Okay, all right.
And then the fourth T is theology.
Theology, ooh,
so to what degree is our change process and the vision for that change congruent with our beliefs and our values? Because if it's seen as incongruent with the beliefs and values, it'll be resisted just on that basis.
Yeah.
So if leaders are able to communicate, as we saw in Acts 15, when the early Christian movement was welcoming Gentiles,
yes.
And the leadership was able to say, you know, we have a history. If we look at the Hebrew Scriptures, mm-hmm. we have a history of God welcoming the Gentiles and wanting the children of Israel to be a light for the Gentiles. And so they were nesting their plea for change in their core theology.
Yeah.
And that's how we are successful when it comes to congregational or religious leadership, religious organizational change as well.
Okay. Now, is this like copyrighted, or can I make like a T-shirt with these 4 T's on it?
Well, please do. I'd be honored.
Okay. This is great. I mean, I think those are really important things that we forget about. I mean, I think we try to do it, but I'm not sure if we put all these T's together. We are good at forming committees, but they aren't often diverse. They don't bring in the right voices, I think, some of our committees that we form when we're trying to do something different in churches. So I think that's one of the areas where we maybe fall a little bit short. And sometimes we try to kind of, you know, fix the process in a certain direction based on who we pick on those teams.
Well, I started consulting with congregations in 1987, so I've been at it for a while. But I used a traditional model. I would come in, interview a bunch of people, write up my findings, my recommendation, submit my bill, and leave.
Yeah.
And then I would made the mistake of checking in a year later to see if any change had taken place.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we have your report somewhere. Can't quite remember what we did with it and don't really know if anything changed. And I realized it was because it was about me. It was about me coming in, uh-huh. talking to people individually, writing up a report and leaving. Yeah. And it wasn't about them. And so 10 years after that, I said, I'll work with your congregation organization if you agree to form a reference team.
Oh.
5 to 7 members yeah. representing the diversity of your congregation, and I'll work with them through the process of change. Okay. And then implementation went from 40% of recommendations to 80% of recommendations.
Ooh, okay.
Simply because it was Who's not about one person yeah. from the outside coming in. It was about a team of people from the inside.
Wow, that's great. I mean, I think that's great. And so... So those are really good tips. So, and I think this needs to probably be on our website webinar beyond this podcast, because I think that's good information and things that we're struggling with as we face this 500-year shift in Christendom. And I think some people think that it's just Mennonite Church USA.
Oh my, no.
But it's the broader
yes.
Christian church.
So all of the mainline denominations have experienced just about all some significant membership loss over the last 20, 30, 40 mm-hmm. years. And now many of the evangelical traditions are experiencing the same, including the Southern Baptist, just a little bit behind. And it's because of the broader shift in American society. The society is secularizing.
Yeah.
And the emphasis on Christian nationalism right now is a very negative reaction to that secularization.
Yeah.
But it is a reaction to it.
All right. And so we spoke a little bit earlier about this topic, because this is something I'm really interested in. I just read a book, The Great Dechurching, by Jim Davis, and he talks a little bit about the Christian nationalism, the rise of that, and the impact of people leaving leaving churches. Yeah. But you pointed out too that earlier on, there were some times when the more progressive groups were shifting and doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, political enmeshment is not a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the congregations that and denominations that experienced political involvement in the 60s and 70s yeah. were primarily on the progressive end, including
right.
in support of the civil rights.
Oh, yeah, movement. Yeah.
And congregations, denominations that were getting involved in politics on the evangelical end were primarily in the 80s and following with Ronald Reagan
yeah.
and other leaders.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's something that we need to pay attention to as we think about what's going on. Because when we have these shifts in society and then shifts in our culture, we tend to just get locked in on our little small window of time. But It's maybe Christian nationalism is a reaction to, I think it definitely is, some of the things that happened with the civil rights movement, the church's involvement in those eras, and now it's kind of swung a little bit toward the other side. So, I mean, what do we do when we are, as a church, are embroiled in these things and we're facing conflicts and disagreements? How do we work through those things?
So in terms of conflicts and disagreements, I think leadership is key. Leadership at the congregational level, which is both ordained pastors as well as lay leaders, leadership at the conference level, leadership at the denominational level. As goes the leadership, so goes the church.
Yes.
When it comes to conflict.
I think you should say that again.
As goes the leadership, so goes the church.
Yes, that's why I believe that wholeheartedly.
And I've learned that by watching congregations where the leaders split
yeah.
and then the church split right after that. And I've seen congregations where the leaders hung together and the
right.
church hung together.
Right.
Because people tend to follow leaders.
Right. So Sister Mary, who sits in the third pew from the left in the back, is usually not the person that's causing the split.
Well, it may be a variety of contributions.
Okay.
And one thing I learned studying polarization is that the national polarization uh-huh. is impacting every subsystem in American
yeah.
society.
Yeah.
It's impacting our families, it's impacting our communities, it's impacting our congregations, it's impacting our denominational systems. So there are these huge outside forces
yeah.
that are also
yeah.
affecting us. But as goes the leadership, so goes the church, because if the leadership is able to model, we are committed to each other, to working together
yeah.
to move forward, the congregation by and large will do likewise.
Yeah.
If the leaders split, that's going to have a ripple effect through the congregation.
Yeah, I know leaders make a difference, and I think you've kind of alluded to that too in your observations. Leadership makes a difference, and you might not want to answer this question. This is my opinion, though. I do find it harmful and maybe somewhat disingenuous when leaders say, when they're going through a conflict, leaders say, "Well, I don't have an opinion. I'm just neutral." I think that's so damaging.
I agree completely. But more importantly, Speed Lease, who was the senior consultant for the Alban Institute for several decades, said there were two styles of leadership that got a leader in trouble. Okay. He said the first won't surprise you. It was the autocratic leader.
Okay.
It's my way or the highway. You either get on board or you get out of the way. You're either for me or you're against me. Mm-hmm. He said inevitably that tended to begin to split a congregation.
Yeah.
The second style, which he says caused just as much church conflict and problems as the first, he called the undefined leader.
The undefined leader, ooh.
People would say, well, Pastor, what do you think we should do?
Yeah.
I don't really have an opinion. I'm just here to help you express your opinion. That drove people nuts because they knew that he, she, they did have an opinion and weren't willing to express it. And so those leaders were seen as manipulative.
Yeah.
So the two styles that don't work, we know this, are autocratic and undefined.
Okay.
What does seem to work is what family systems theory calls the defined leader, where it's basically about self-definition. This is who I am and what I believe. And I'm equally interested in who you are and what you believe, and I want to stay connected with you. Mm. So it's self-defined and connected. And that's a rare combination.
Yeah, yeah. You should do this for a living. You're good at this. So
you're very kind.
But okay, so I
taught for 23
years. Yeah, you know, so. You do. You're really good at this. And so this is how I would define it. Don't be a jerk. That's the first type of leader, the jerk leader. Don't
right.
be a jerk.
Right.
Don't edit this out too. Whoever's editing this video, lead us in. These two types of leaders that I don't appreciate: the jerk leader and the wet noodle. Those are Glenn's terms for it.
That's good. Did I use those?
Yes, okay. Yes. The wet noodle leader and the jerk. Don't be either one of those types of leaders. I think it's really important for us to understand that, though, for pastors and denominational leaders, conference leaders, it's important that we have this defined leadership. That's an important role that we play in the community.
It's very important, although it's much easier to say than it is to do. So
maybe.
And I know this from being a department chair for 6 years and being a dean for 5 years, being an executive director before that.
Yeah.
It's easy to say, self-define and stay connected. And I actually think I'm a bit better at the stay connected side.
Okay.
And there's sometimes on issues, I either haven't thought my way through it or I'm not yet willing to say it.
Yeah.
And so then I think it's helpful to say, you deserve a response,
right.
But I'm not ready to give that right now.
Yeah.
And let's schedule time when we can talk about it.
Yeah.
Because we can't self-define on everything all the time.
No, that's right, right. Yeah. I mean, but part of that self-definition, I think, is really knowing what your strengths are and your weaknesses are. And if you can't, I think the other part of it is going back to your four T's is teams. You need to know what type of team you have to build around yourself as a leader.
Yeah.
I know that I'm not necessarily the most naturally empathetic leader. And so I want to make sure that I have empathetic people on my team so they can kind of translate for me when I'm dealing with people. I can say, hey, now if I say this to this person, how will it be perceived? Am I being too harsh? Am I being clear? So I think that part of self-definition is knowing your strengths and knowing your weaknesses and then kind of finding your systems to help you navigate that.
Well said. Watch out for leaders who communicate, I alone can fix it.
Nope, you can't do that. Yeah.
That will never work.
Yep.
And so what's the team that we're building around ourselves?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. Well, how do we, I don't know. How can we develop those leaders? I think that's part of the problem, right? We need... the congregation doesn't always inherit leaders. They choose these leaders. So how can we pick better leaders, or what do we look for?
So I didn't listen to all of your podcasts from series one, but that seemed to be a theme
of
a number of them I did listen to. What did you learn from that?
What did I learn from it about selecting leaders?
Well, I think and equipping leaders.
Yeah, I think part of it is mentorship. I really believe in mentorship. Yeah. So that... that we need to pour ourselves into up and coming people so that they can figure out who they are and we can help guide them along that path.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But by the way, one thing I learned as a father, my boys are now 31 and 27, but I learned they would occasionally listen to what I would say, but they were always watching what I would do.
Yeah.
And so the mentorship piece matters more than a lecture in a classroom.
Yeah. Yeah. Mentorship modeling. I do think that we need some training. For leaders to help them hone those skills. And everyone is, I think, helping leaders find their authentic style. But I don't know how you do that other than getting out there and leading. I think that's the only way that you can see who you are, where you are. And that's how I learned my lessons. But I had really good mentors.
And you must have.
Yeah, I had really good mentors, and I've studied leadership because I'm really interested in it. Just kind of part of it, I think, is really finding this self-definition. I really like that. But finding out who you are, what your style is, and becoming comfortable with who you are as a leader. But again, you pointed out, if any leader comes and say, hey, I can fix it all, he's probably going to be one of the jerk leader.
It's a self-deception.
Yeah. Because you can't do it alone. You have to have other people. And if anything, you would elevate the gifts and skills of those other people.
One thing John Paul Lederach used to say, which I thought was helpful, was however long it took us to get into this situation, that's how long it's going to take you to get out of it. And so when we look at the history in our country of white racism, for example, of genocide against the Native American population, those things happened over centuries and take centuries to completely move past them.
Yeah.
And we're still in that process.
Yeah, and it hasn't been, I mean, people think it's been centuries, but it actually hasn't been that long. I mean, my biological father, I tell people all the time, was born in 1907. I think 1903 was when W.E. Du Bois wrote the Negro Problem, wrote that book. And so that's, coming out of the Civil War and those things. So it's like I'm just a couple of generations away from slavery. And so people think, hey, this is far, far away, distant time. But it's a lot of people that were integral in some of these laws and processes that are still around today.
And it shows how embedded those things have become in our systems,
including
our church systems, that requires real effort naming the realities, first of all, and then this kind of commitment to address them.
Yeah. And so what do you contribute to causing the polarization that we have now? Because I think it's different from, well, maybe it's not different. Maybe we just have more access, but what do you think has contributed to it?
First thing I would say is this is the fourth time in American history that we've had significant polarization in the country.
Okay.
The Civil War being the most obvious in the 1860s. But before that, the Revolutionary War was accompanied by about 80,000 loyalists fleeing the country because they wanted to stay loyal to the king.
Okay.
Some went to Canada, some went back to England, but it was not like everybody was a patriot.
Yeah.
Then you had the Civil War, then you had the 1960s, which I remember because I was about 10 years old in 1968. There's a lot about the current environment that is reminiscent of 1968.
Yeah.
And here we are now. So every century in this country's history, starting with the 18th century, the 19th, the 20th, and now the 21st, we've had major polarization.
Yeah.
So I looked at 10 possible drivers of polarization,
but
I'll only give you three.
Okay, tell me what you think they are.
These three seem to be the most significant.
Okay.
And the first is when there is significant gap between the rich and the poor,
what
we call income stratification.
Yep.
And this is true around the world. We can go to almost any other country, for example, South Africa, Brazil, where there's very high levels of income stratification.
Mm-hmm.
There's also high levels of political polarization.
Yep.
And it makes sense because people feel excluded. They feel left behind. Some are getting really rich and other people are dropping behind. So as we've increased income stratification in the last 40 years, we've also increased political polarization.
Yep.
And the second is identity threat.
Okay.
When any group feels that their identity is under threat, it can contribute to that feeling of being at risk and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be a very genuine identity threat, such as African-American males encountering state violence, which happens at a higher rate than white males, unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be a perceived identity threat, what we call a status threat. So one of the drivers of Christian nationalism is the feeling by many white Christians that they are losing status, that the country is becoming majority-minority, and that is a driver of polarization. People respond.
Yep.
But then the third key is to have someone who articulates that grievance.
Oh, okay.
So it's not enough just to have income stratification and just have identity threat. Somebody has to basically say, the reason why you're falling behind is the Chinese or the immigrants.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the reason you're falling behind are the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can come from the left or the right. But when you combine those three variables, it seems like polarization is inevitable. Those are the drivers.
Yeah.
That's not the cures.
Right, those are the drivers, yeah. Well, and I think that, and maybe this is kind of wrapped into your income, we're really nerding out on organizational stuff now, I know. But the income stratification, part of that, I think, is then you have significant shifts, which are also significant shifts in labor and economic how we earn our money. And I think that those timelines that you talked about really line up with that. You know, you had the taxation issue with England. You have the end of slavery, and, you know, you have all the free labor is gone now. You have to do something to pay these slaves. So a big shift of economics. And then you have the Industrial Revolution and people moving in urban areas. And so less farm work, more industrial work, technology shifts. And so now we're in an age where we have influx of immigrants and we have AI, right?
And
so,
outsourcing to and cheaper labor countries.
Yeah, you know? So I think that those things all seem to line up. And I think it's good for us as a church to really think about that, because we can have an impact on some of these things.
I think it's important to center our identity in Jesus, in the church, and to be really clear that we want to be a church for all of God's people, and what we're gathering around is the table of Christ.
Yeah.
And I think MCUSA has attempted to lead that way very well.
Mm-hmm. So, but how do we address some of these, the real issues that people are facing as the church? I mean, how do you see that being lived out?
So there are some interesting examples of congregations that have decided to be as externally focused as they are internally focused, that they want to be a church for their community, not just for their members.
Ooh, yep.
And so what I say is the best antidote to destructive internal conflict is an external focus.
Okay.
So I wrote about this in an article I titled "Want Less Conflict?"
Yeah.
Question mark. Look out the window.
Okay.
And get out the door.
All right, we need to get that. We need to get that article and connect it.
I'm happy to.
We'll link it to this this podcast.
I'll send you that along with the four T's.
Okay. All right. So it's four T's.
Because having an external focus really shifts, and I'm not talking about externally focused in terms of trying to elect a Republican or Democrat.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about the local community where we are.
Yeah.
And right now in our community here in the Harrisonburg, Rockingham County area, we have something called VIA, Valley Interfaith Action.
Oh, okay.
And I'm one of the representatives from Parkview Mennonite Church. And we are focused on affordable child care, okay, which is a huge need in this community, and affordable transportation, another huge need. And those are nonpartisan issues. So we're working with local representatives from a variety of perspectives, county supervisors and others, to try to address those two issues collectively. Because I think when a congregation starts to see something they can accomplish collectively with other congregations, again, Lone Rangers always fail.
Right.
But something that we can do collectively with others, that it shifts us from this obsessive focus on ourselves and even the obsessive focus on national politics, where we don't have much of an impact, quite frankly.
Right.
We have much more of an impact at the local level, but that goes up.
Right.
We talk about something that is a nested model, that what we do at the local level matters all the way at the top, just as what happens at the top matters all the way at the local level.
Right, right. Yeah, we have to, part of this is knowing where to focus our time and our energy and time, and, you know, we only have a limited amount of that, and so we definitely really need to bring these things into focus if we hope to, I think, combat the things that are going on in our society. Again, with Christ as the centering piece of what we do, I think that's very important for us to remember as Anabaptists and Mennonites. I think we love us some social justice, but it's really this social justice that's connected to us being part of this Christian community, right? Being part of the way.
We also, I think, have to guard against exceptionalism. Okay. The belief that we're exceptional as Anabaptists or as Americans,
right.
That belief tends to lead to denial. That it keeps us from facing the realities that we need to face.
Yeah, yeah. I think American exceptionalism has been challenged recently.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of humbling. It's interesting to see that shift. I actually went to, when I was part of Mennonite World Conference, went to in Indonesia, and you know, I remember it wasn't too long ago you would go place and say, "Oh, you're American. Oh, we want to come to America. You know, America is great." And then I talked to some people in Indonesia. Would you ever be interested in coming to America? Oh no, we would get shot. We don't want to go. It's just amazing that shift.
the rest of the world sees things more clearly sometimes than we do about ourselves.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I could talk about this with you probably for another hour.
It was fun.
But I'm going to have another conversation about you because I'm going to get my T-shirt and we're going to post this so people can hear this because I think this is a very, very important message for the leaders of our church.
Well, thank you for your leadership. It has been very significant to watch the last 6 years.
But thank you so much for joining me for this. And it was just a pleasure being able to talk to you today.
Likewise. Thank you, Glenn.
All right. Want to keep up with the latest and greatest that is happening in Mennonite Church USA? Subscribe to Piecemeal. Piecemeal is our weekly email newsletter. Subscribe at MennoniteUSA.org/piecemeal. Your financial support matters. Please consider supporting the ongoing ministry work of Mennonite Church USA at MennoniteUSA.org/give. Thank you so much for joining us today.